The only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, Amanda French, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus, episode 80, recorded January 20th, 2012. Law Soup. Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Campus, the podcast for people interested in all things at the intersection of technology, teaching, learning, museums, libraries, and archives. I'm Tom Scheinfeld from Found History, here with a couple of the regulars, Dan Cohen from dancohen.org. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Tom.
And Mills Kelly from edwire.org. Hey, Mills.
Hey, Tom. Hey, Dan.
And we're minus, as far as we can tell, we're minus Amanda this week. Amanda is on vacation, and I think she's probably thought of some better things to do on the beach than...
How could that possibly be? Is there anything better than recording a podcast?
Yeah, then join us. Sorry, lot here in the snow. But I'll keep an eye out on the Skype to see if she turns up, and we'll add Amanda in if she can join us and is willing to show her face. And we're very lucky this week. We've actually got a bunch of stories that fall into the realm of law and copyright and intellectual property, and we're very lucky this week to be joined by someone who I understand is a listener to the podcast as an irregular to the podcast, Peter Hurdle, who is an archivist and a senior policy advisor in the Cornell University Library, who spends most of his time thinking, I think, about intellectual property issues for Cornell and for the rest of us. So welcome, Peter.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah, that's right. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Peter has... Peter's a friend of the center and someone we've paid attention to for a long time and who occasionally chimes in with an email correcting our very amateur analysis of legal issues. And so we have plenty of those to deal with this week. And so it'll be good to have you on, and we can avoid the mistakes to begin with. But there was another announcement. I think it was an amazing announcement. It was a groundbreaking announcement. It was a revolutionary announcement. It was the most revolutionary announcement I think we've heard since Apple's last announcement from Apple of a new program that they have to revolutionize textbooks. And it includes a couple of different parts. One is a new iBooks 2, a new version of its electronic bookstore, which will now include textbooks for download by students. A new piece of software called iBooks Author, which has been called sort of GarageBand for writing books, a new version of iTunes U, which kind of adds some functionality to make iTunes U more of a kind of learning management environment. Mills, I'm going to ask, as our resident watcher of all things education, I'm going to ask you what you think of these announcements. I think probably from my introduction, you can tell I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, I noticed that, and I have to say, at the moment, I'm skeptical. I'm willing to be impressed on this one, but I'm skeptical at the moment for a couple of reasons. One of them is that, you know, this is another walled garden, and And so that's problematic because it only functions in the Apple environment, and that's still such a small chunk of the market in schools that schools and colleges that I'm kind of skeptical that it's gonna take hold quickly. Of course, I can't remember if I was skeptical about iPods or not, but they certainly took over. But the sort of the walled garden nature of it bothers me. The second reason I'm skeptical is because, and this is something Dan talked about several podcasts back, when we were talking about the iPad 2, however long ago that was, that, you know, the price on these is only going to get so low. And because the components have a base cost that really can't be circumvented. And these things are expensive. And, you know, the Apple product is expensive. And so that really has the potential to create a class divide if really cool stuff is getting created for iPads and is unavailable and unusable in other formats. Then it's only in prosperous places or for prosperous people that this has any relevance. And that, I think, is really problematic. The iPod, they were able to drive the price down pretty low, and there were cheap imitators that you could use that worked fine. They just didn't have quite the coolness factor. But so that's I think, problematic. And the third is that third reason I'm a little skeptical is because really the big market for textbooks is at the K-12 level, and this just isn't going to happen at the K-12 level anytime soon. So it's just not going to – spending a lot of time in schools these days with my own kids, it's just not going to happen anytime soon, except in perhaps the most prosperous places or in private schools that have resources to work with. But your average public school system just isn't going to be adopting this anytime soon, nor do the teachers have the time to create all of this content. That's the other thing is, you know, college professors, we have more time to create content, but the average K-12 teacher or – in some respects, the person teaching at the community college just doesn't have the time to play with stuff. They just need a resource that they can slap down in front of their students and go with. So that's all the reasons for skepticism. On the optimistic side, I'm sure I've said it on the podcast. I've certainly said it in things I've written. I think textbooks in general are just horrible. And I have nothing – well, in the textbooks I know in history, I just think they're not good. They're hugely problematic for a whole variety of reasons, and I wish they would all just evaporate from the planet tomorrow. And so can you tell I don't like them? And so anything that has the potential to improve a textbook, I think, is to the good. So I'm hopeful that something good might come out of this. Really, as I was thinking about this new thing when the stories came out this week, it seemed to me that the real application is going to be much more in the sciences and engineering. I mean, I can imagine some very interesting interactive things happening for engineering students with this kind of platform. And so for history and the humanities in general, I don't know. So to call me a hopeful skeptic.
Yeah. The cost issue, one of the things that the announcement said was that the pricing of these textbooks is going to be $15 or less. Now, at least it's my understanding, and you guys might correct me if I'm wrong, that's for high school textbooks. They haven't announced pricing on college textbooks yet, so it could be more for college textbooks or it could be less. But $15 for high school textbooks, which is less than what high school textbooks cost now. So the idea is that, you know, the device would pay for itself over time as schools bought more textbooks. I think you're right, Mills, absolutely, that, you know, it's hard to imagine, Fairfax County Public Schools sort of saying, you know, yes, we're going to, like, buy every student and,
we're going to buy 80,000 iPads.
Right. We're going to buy 80,000 iPads. Like, when does that fit into the budget cycle? That's the problem, is like, how does that enter into the kind of, and it has to be iPads, you know, it can't be, they can't take bids on these things.
And by the way, all of our existing networking systems in our schools are all PC based.
Yeah, right.
Nothing, so we're going to throw all that out too.
Yeah.
So all those smart boards we just installed over the last few years at an ungodly cost, not only to the room, but also the electrical draw from those things. So, yeah. I don't see it happening.
And it doesn't seem that the new Apple is ready to do the kind of thing that the old Apple did, which is cut prices on its hardware. For the education market. Dan, how do you feel about this, both about the kind of business model aspects of it, but also about the kind of content of these new textbooks, whether you know, is this going to revolutionize the textbook market, I guess is my question, and is it going to revolutionize the textbook?
Right. Well, so I just before we got on the air, I sort of tweeted a joking, well, not so joking, link to these Voyager expanding books, which were
right.
almost exactly the same thing. Bob Stein, who really was a visionary about this and founded the Institute for the Future of the Book, you know, he was talking about books that did precisely this. I mean, embedded video, Zoom, you know, audio, nonlinear ways of making your way through the text. I believe there was a Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy edition that came out in the Voyager Expanded Books series that came on a 3.5-inch floppy for the Mac. And, you know, I think this idea has been around for a long time. And, my feeling on it is, I think, a lot like Mills, that, you know, textbooks are textbook. There's, you know, you can dress them up, you can add multimedia, but it doesn't get at the heart, which is the mechanisms of adoption of textbooks, which are really a different thing than having a very snazzy textbook in color and with touch capabilities and videos of ants moving around and things like that. That's not what sells the textbook. So, you know, I think this is a kind of it was sort of, I think the presentation yesterday at the Guggenheim was something like a 1-hour infomercial for the iPad that just happened to involve textbooks, right? I mean, everyone's going to remember, oh, you know, if they're going to buy a Kindle Fire, they'll have in their brain, oh, wow, but Apple has these incredible textbooks on the iPad. And it shows off the iPad really well because it's got a big form factor that's much more like the folio size that you'd have in a textbook. So that works really well against the 7-inch form factor. But, you know, it's just I've got kids in elementary school. You go in there and they probably spend per year several thousand dollars total in the whole school on technology. So there's 900 kids in my kid's school. So, you know, you do the math. They don't have $450,000 to spend on iPads for everyone, even if the textbooks then cost $15. So just the mechanics of adoption and even just things like sales and support. I mean, the SmartBoard folks, I think, are really smart in the ways in which they – you know, they've really pushed these ridiculous things into the school systems, but they've got great sales and they, you know how to market to these school systems. And then at the college level, I think the one kind of interesting development was this iTunes U getting the ability to host syllabi and lesson right. plans and quizzes. And, you know, some people were sort of saying, oh, you know, they're moving into the Blackboard area. But even there, again, you get to the mechanics of adoption. If you look at Blackboard, for instance, on Mason's campus, Blackboard not only runs the syllabi that we write, it also runs the payment system in the cafeteria. I mean, this is the kind of ruthless business people right. that run Blackboard. So it's, you know, you can have a fancy textbook, that's one thing, but actually getting it into circulation, getting it used in the classroom is an entirely different thing. And I think they're going to have a tough time with this. And I think it will end up being seen as just a kind of larger marketing opportunity for the wonders of the iPad.
Right. I was thinking the same thing about iTunes U. I mean, I think some faculty will choose to do some interesting things with it. It's just institutionally, which they've already done, you know, faculty have chosen to do interesting things with iTunes U for years now. But as an institutional, as a Blackboard killer, right, it doesn't tie in with the university's authentication systems. It doesn't tie in with all of the registration information. It doesn't tie in with any of that. And really, that's what universities, whether they need it or not, that's what universities have been grown accustomed to with Blackboard and all of the other large enterprise systems. Peter, how are you feeling after the Apple announcement? Were you feeling revolutionized?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that struck me as the most interesting was the release of the iBooks author application and the idea that somehow we could sit down and start creating our own textbooks and authoring them, or imagine a school system or a state that would say, let's generate our own textbook for the state rather than relying upon one from a commercial publisher. Dan mentioned Bob Stein, and of course, they've been working on this SOFI software for a long time to try to do creative interactive books, and it really hasn't gotten any legs yet. And so if Apple could come up with a really useful and clever and simple to use authoring tool for interactive books, that might be exciting. What's given me pause are some of the blog postings that have pointed out the end user license associated with the this that insists that if you're going to sell the book, it has to be sold through Apple and can't be sold in any other venue. Though you can give it away for free in any venue. So this, you know, might be a wonderful way of sitting down and saying, let's have open access, freely available textbooks that are generated through this. But so that's what I found exciting, is if the authoring tools might work well. But Dan's point about trying to get adoption in a school system is a really excellent one, too.
So, Peter, what was your feeling on the EULA for, let's say, faculty at the college level who maybe authored something in iBooks Author and did want to sell it? I mean, how does this mesh with all the regulations around work for hire and what professorial work is? And, you know, I'm just perplexed about how this squares with the legal regulations around university work.
So it doesn't the
or,
license,
or at iTunes U, same thing there. But yeah, go ahead.
The license itself doesn't affect the copyright in the work at all. So if your university says that what you write belongs to the university, then that would still be the case. Or if the policy says that what you write belongs to you, that would still be the case. My understanding is that all Apple is saying is that if you use this application to create the work, and you are going to then distribute it for a fee, it has to be through Apple, even though you may still own the copyright in it. And that's the part of a quid pro quo of using the free software. If you don't like it, don't use the software. I'm worried, though, that people may be caught up short by this. You hate to see somebody sit down and develop a really complex application, think that they can export it into PDF to use on CreateSpace or some other publishing platform, and come up short and realize they're locked into the Apple distribution mechanisms.
Right. I mean, right. It's actually a really interesting contrast with, speaking of these Voyager books, I might be wrong about this, but weren't they created in HyperCard or some of these used HyperCard? And that I think since then everyone's had this kind of yearning to have a new HyperCard or some really easy way for non-programmers to create interactive content. HyperCard was, you know, much more open. Obviously, there was nothing like a store at that point for HyperCard stacks. But I think people have been missing that. And I think this EULA kind of rubbed people the wrong way who, you know, have been looking for a really snazzy authoring system for the average user. And after all, Apple must realize that most of these things would be used on Macs anyway, or that it would still encourage purchases of iPads. But this sort of extra step to lock it to the store for actual, you know, for fee sales, there's something quite wrong about it.
It is really, I mean, it is really the EULA thing. And another listener, John Erickson, alerted us to this this morning. I mean, the EULA thing is really, I mean, it's incredibly audacious. I mean, it's akin to saying that anything produced in Final Cut must be sold by Apple. So that would apply to, like, major Hollywood movies. I mean, or it's saying anything written in Microsoft Word has to be sold through Microsoft. I mean, I guess not belongs to Apple, but has to be sold through Apple. Right. Apple gets it would be akin to saying, and when you sell it through Apple, that means Apple gets a 30% cut. I mean, can you imagine if they insisted on that for Final Cut or for if Microsoft did for Microsoft Word? I mean, it really is. I mean, or GarageBand. Think of all the music that's composed in GarageBand.
What I don't get on these things is that the defaults really do matter a lot. If they had something where, you know, you finish doing your book and you can see it in the interface that they've shown in the videos, there's a, you know, one click like upload to iBooks, right? I mean, your average user is still going to do that upload to the iBooks bookstore, sorry. And the average user is still going to do that. I mean, what percentage is going to go through the hassle of like figuring out which of the 20 different Android stores they're going to sell their book in? I don't see the marginal gain that they get out of this versus the loss of goodwill.
Really want to do that.
Yeah.
I guess
right.
the one big difference is that we purchase Word and the authoring tool here is free. And, you know, so Apple's saying we have to, if we're going to give you free software and we'll make our money on the back end. It's sort of a clever business model that way.
Yeah. It's just the fact that it's buried in the EULA, though, is a little worrying in that, you know, it's just that quid pro quo is not made. I mean, it's made explicit, but it's not maybe made terribly apparent to the user when they first start out. Well, I think we'll continue to watch this. It'll be interesting to see what kind of fallout from this EULA there is, and what kind of uptake these textbooks get over the next months and years. I think, you know, it's hard to tell. Apple has had a lot of hits, but we'll see if this is another in that long string of hits. Well, turning to some technical matters in another realm, it's been a busy couple of weeks on the open access intellectual property copyright front.
Is this the part of the show where we dub in the Law and Order song?
Dun dun
dun
yes.
dun. Yes, yeah. Right. Segment, the law segment of the podcast.
You can't do that. That's a copyrighted sound.
Just those two notes, right? I'm sure they are. Gosh, great. All right.
Peter, the copyright expert, bringing us down. Now we can't even use the Law and Order sound.
I copyrighted C sharp last week, actually.
The way things are going, you're going to be able to do that soon. But we've got at least three stories here that we've all, I think, been looking at. And in fact, I think after Wednesday, I think most of the world is probably aware of the first one. And those stories are, we've been following the progress of SOPA and PIPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act. Those are the bills marching or that were marching through Congress to protect copyrighted work, mainly pushed by the Hollywood movie and music industries to stop online file sharing and BitTorrent and Pirate Bay and these kinds of things, but which had some fairly what I think a lot of us would say draconian remedies for those copyright violations written into them. That's the first thing we'll talk about. We'll talk about the Research Works Act, which one of the things I think we've followed for a long time here on the podcast are the federal government's efforts to insist that federally funded grant funded research is made freely available to everyone, that the products of that research is made freely available to everyone through things like PubMed and other open access outlets. And then we're going to take a look at a recent Supreme Court decision, Golan versus Holder, which has some implications for how for foreign copyright foreign copyright acts and for Congress's ability to put works into the back into copyright retrospectively. So a lot to deal with here. We'll start off with SOPA and PIPA. And did any of you try to access Wikipedia on Wednesday?
Oh, of course. I did accidentally.
You did accidentally? And were you surprised?
I had forgotten. I had forgotten, and I had very important academic research to do on a topic in popular culture, and hit Wikipedia, and then realized it. Yeah, I saw. Actually, what was weird is because the JavaScript actually saw the underlying page for a half second, and then it did the black and gray overlay.
Yeah, what we're talking about here is on Wednesday, a bunch of major internet properties and a lot of minor ones went black for the day to protest these two bills. Wikipedia was one of them. Mozilla was another. And they blacked out their websites to show that this is what the internet would look like if these bills passed. Peter, do you think those protests are going to be effective? And how do you feel about these two bills?
I guess, a little bit cynical when it comes to Congress now and what influences them. I do think that the exciting thing about this, Wikipedia doesn't matter that much, but the idea that Google, Microsoft, that the new media has become concerned about this and is coming to Congress and is protesting a bill that I'm sure was written by a group of lawyers sitting around in old media shops like the MPAA and the Motion Picture Association of America and the RIAA, and then handed over to Congress. This is the underlying threat here is the digital future, and the fact that we've seen Silicon Valley get engaged with the legislative process. I'm very encouraged about that.
Yeah, it is sort of setting up to be at times in the last couple of weeks through all of this, the big Silicon Valley companies also, or several executives from them, also took out a full page ad in the New York Times protesting this bill a couple of weeks ago. I mean, sometimes it's almost seemed as like Northern California versus Southern California. That these two big hubs of media and information are really at odds over this bill.
And of course, Wikipedia was working just fine on my iPhone on Wednesday, which is, I guess, evidence of that old saw that the internet views censorship as just a block and routes around it. And the same thing would probably happen if SOPA or PIPA actually passed. Trying to black out anything is very, very difficult.
Yeah. Well, and it's actually penetrated into the consciousness of America's youth, because my recently 15-year-old said at the dinner table, "So, Dad, do you think SOPA is really going to pass?"
Wow. That's encouraging. I mean, I think that really was the result of the protests. Like, all of a sudden, everybody was talking about SOPA, which, had been sort of we all talk about it, but we're people who follow these things.
Mills, how did you answer?
I told him I didn't think so. I said that I thought that, in fact, that there were just sort of too much pressure in the sort of general first of all, I said I didn't think it was going to pass because it is kind of anti-free market in a way, and so there will be some constituency in the Congress that will not like it for that reason, or also just that it's yet another government regulation. And I said, and the other problem is it's just truly unenforceable, as you were saying, Peter. It's the odds that it's going to work are just next to zero, and so I think that at some point it makes sort of good propaganda points, but doesn't make good policy.
And we all know that Congress has never passed a law that won't work.
Yeah, the problem is, it was one that would require money behind it, because there would have to be an enforcement regime, and that's the part that there's no money for. So I'm hoping that will ultimately prevail.
Well, I tend to agree that these bills are probably pretty close to dead, but I think we can expect another version of SOPA to come down the line.
As we're talking here on Friday, the 20th of January, that Lamar Smith, who is the chief sponsor of SOPA, said that he's pulling the bill until there's wider agreement on a solution. So,
right.
You know, you can read that two ways. They are pulling the bill called SOPA, but you know, they're going to try to come back with something else that does the same thing.
Right. I mean, I can't imagine the RIAA and the MPAA, they're not just going to kind of give up on this. Certainly their lawyers aren't.
They'll figure. Lawyers get, you know, this is what they get paid the big bucks for.
Yeah. Well, another kind of, you know, in some ways related thing in that it represents a kind of a legal maneuver by an old media industry to protect its interests. But one that probably hits a little closer to home is this Research Works Act. Peter, can you give us a little background on the Research Works Act and what it is and what it hopes to do?
Sure. Well, the Research Works Act, you have to understand the context of the NIH mandate, which says that if you receive NIH funding, you have to make your accepted manuscript that you generate from that funding and available openly at least 12 months after publication. So the idea is that if you worked at NIH, your stuff, there's no copyright in it and it's freely available immediately. And now they're saying if the public is funding research, then the public has some right to access that at some point. And it's been very successful for NIH with copies of articles going into PubMed Central. There's been bills proposed in the past to extend this to other federal granting agencies such as NSF and the Department of Energy. And there was just a call from the White House's Office of Science and Technology Policy to comment upon this and see whether it should be extended. So anyway, the publishers, for reasons that are unclear to me, don't like this. They somehow feel that they don't want to have any requirement that material that they may eventually end up publishing can be made freely available. So the law very simply says that no federal agency can demand open access of material as a requirement of the grant.
Yeah, and I mean we've talked about these kinds of mandates on the podcast a lot, and I think, you know, we've been roundly supportive of them, and it's very worrying that this has now come to the attention of Congress. You know, they're going to be, you know, it's again one of these. Unlike SOPA, where there is a, you know, there is a big, you know, opposite pole in Silicon Valley, another kind of very strong, powerful industry that's against the legislation. I worry about this, in that, you know, there's an industry that's for this act. You know, there's an industry who's really for locking these things down. I worry that where is that other pole? You know, there's all of us, and we're going to be, you know, bummed out by this. But who? You know, where's the other lobby? That's what worries me about this. Dan, how have you been? You've been, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that this is an outrage. You know, it's I find it very strange, and I still haven't seen the full reasoning behind why this happened now. I mean, think about it. This was an act that was introduced on the eve of Christmas Eve. Right. It was put out. The first people heard about it was on the 23rd of Friday, the 23rd of December, 2011. You know, this is like very classic what you would do if you want to, you know, sort of dump a body. You know, you
right. you do this. Purely coincidental that they picked that date. Purely coincidental. I swear.
And what I find really strange about it is, you know, if you look at how things are going, even the big publishers have sort of, I thought, you know, sort of accepted the fact that there's going to be significant amounts of work in open access venues and that they've found other ways to make money off of it. And indeed, there was a really great, you know, rejection of the Research Works Act by Nature Publishing Group. Came out with a statement this week where they said, this is ridiculous. You know, we disagree with the AAP and, you know, we believe, you know, and this is Nature. I mean, they're making a lot of money off of these kinds of works, particularly in STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, and medicine fields. You know, and they said, we understand that, you know, in the future, we're going to have to make money off of discovery tools and service tools and in addition to, you know, subvention fees and things like that for publishing in open access ways. So they've sort of accepted that this is coming down the pike. So I'd like to know more about the, you know, sort of the mechanics of what went on within the AAP that pushed this forward. I still find it very odd because it is frankly a real slap in the face of the scholarly community. Rather brash. I mean, it is a lot like the Apple EULA. It's sort of incredible that they would even try to do it.
Have any of you heard on the chances of success for this? Have we heard anything about whether this is going to move forward or, you know, sometimes
I mean, this is the odd part of it is that there's a lot of kind of hand waving from some publishers saying, things are introduced all the time. It's, you know, et cetera. But, you know, you don't introduce it unless you really want it to become law in some way. I mean, it is a show of your cards and what your intent is as a lobbying group. And so, you know, yes, I suppose lots of things are introduced all the time and this has a very low chance of getting through. I think especially now that SOPA is dead, I think – you know, the internet has come up with some white blood cells to kind of counteract these things. But still, I think it's a very strange and sort of untimely introduction.
The best estimate I've heard is that no one really expects this to pass as is. But the danger is that because it's so short and so brief that it may get tacked on to some other piece of legislation, NIH's authorization or something like that, and that's the thing to watch out for. The as far as why publishers wanted to do that, that is the $64 million question. I haven't heard of any publisher going out of business or losing any money because of the NIH mandate. Here at Cornell, we run the physics preprint archive server in the library, and yet there aren't physics journals going out of business because that's the primary publication venue for high-energy physics now. So it almost seems like it's this, suing faculty members in the university in Georgia State University case on e-reserves, or here trying to assert a kind of ownership rights in material before it's even signed over to them. Publishers almost seem to be doing this as a moral protection of what they perceive as their rights and don't want anyone interfering with them.
Their statement does really read in that, in those kind of high moral tones, that like the government is stealing from us, that, you know, we own these things. We provide this service that, you know, we are essential. I mean, there is a very kind of, you know, and I think it's the same tone that's taken by the lobby supporting SOPA and PIPA as well, is that there's this kind of outrage about, and, you know, real moral indignation about what they see as this sort of perceived wrongs against them. It'll be interesting to see. what happens next and whether it flies. Dan, you have.
That was
Peter.
Oh, yeah. Peter.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Of course, the solution always is if a publisher didn't want to, didn't like the mandate, they just can refuse to accept any articles that have been published with federal funding and let those articles go to PLOS or one of the other journals that will do it. So it they can avoid having their what they think of as their property being stolen that way. They don't need legislation. So it's very curious.
Right, although they know that so much of what they publish is in fact funded by the government, which is the reason for the mandate in the first place. So we'll be watching this. It'll be interesting to see whether it goes anywhere. I think and if it does, what effects it has and how it fares. Moving on to our last story in the realm of copyright and intellectual property. The Supreme Court decided Golan versus Holder, and I believe Mills, we've talked about this on the show before, right?
Yeah.
And you had a sort of special take on this, I think, because you have you use a lot of foreign works in your research and your teaching. Were you following this development?
I will admit that I'd lost track of it just because I'd forgotten that they were going to decide it shortly. And, I'm really sorry that they just did the way that they did. Because it creates my own view, being the legal expert that I am, well-versed in constitutional law, is that it's going to create this quagmire because there's so much – I don't know the rest of the world. I know Europe, and there's just so much work in Europe that is a result of what happened in Europe in the 20th century between the Second World War and the communist takeover in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. There's so much copyrighted work that where the publishing houses are gone, the authors are dead, the and the publishing houses aren't just gone. In the way that like an American publishing house would go out of business and there would be some, legal judgment about the remnants of that business and who had some claim on them. These businesses were just eliminated. They just went away. And so, for instance, in my own area of research, there was a very large publishing house in Prague that published up until the German takeover in 1939, published a lot of scholarly work by 19th and 20th century historians. And that house just it was Aryanized and the owners were sent to their deaths. And their heirs were also killed. And so it's just gone. And so, but somebody could say, oh, well, actually all that work is still in copyright, and they could step forward in some way and make a claim. And we're talking hundreds and hundreds of books of history. And now what do we do about that? And that's just one example. And so it's really murky. And so to say that, U.S. copyright law can be extended over all this other work, it strikes me as just a quagmire.
Peter, I have to admit I had lost track of this a little bit as well. And can you give us a little bit of a rundown on the sort of facts of the case and how it was decided and also sort of what you see as the effects of that decision?
Well, the effects are exactly what Mills has talked about. The idea here was that when the United States joined the Berne International Treaty in 1989, the International Copyright Treaty, one of the requirements of the treaty was that we had to give retrospective protection to works in Berne nations. And that happened by adding Section 104A to the Copyright Act, which gave copyright protection to foreign works that they had never had in the United States. It has the effect of making foreign works much, much more protected than U.S. works are, that only a tiny percentage of works that were written in 1924, say, are protected by copyright in the U.S. If they were written and created in the U.S., but anything created anywhere else in the world is protected by copyright now in the U.S. And the Supreme Court, on a bunch of fairly technical grounds, refused the challenge to this about whether the Congress had the ability to put material that was in the public domain in the United States back into copyright protection was the first issue. And the court, the majority said, yes, the public domain is not absolute, but Congress can, whenever it wants, if it has good policy reasons for doing so, put things from the public domain back under copyright. And in this case, providing international protection to U.S. works was considered a good enough policy reason for doing that. And the other issue was a First Amendment challenge saying that our right to speak is limited if we can't play Peter and the Wolf without having to pay money to do so. And the court said, no, there's no First Amendment challenge here. The traditional First Amendment protections of fair use and what's called the idea expression dichotomy still apply. And just the fact that you have to license the use of Peter and the Wolf doesn't interfere with your First Amendment rights. So in some ways, it's a fairly narrow, and based upon their previous decisions, a not unexpected decision. But the policy implications are, as Mill suggests, horrendous in terms of providing access to a broad cultural heritage. And Stephen Breyer in his dissent came down very, very strong on that. So constitutionally, it may be okay, but it's still not very good policy. And Congress could have been a lot wiser in trying to implement this.
I mean, the piece of that seems to worry me is, I mean, do you think that this sets a precedent whereby Congress can now, if they, you know, if a company came along and, or, you know, a lobby, somehow someone convinced Congress to, you know, put, you know, move that kind of copyright wall on other kinds of works, U.S. works, back to 1900 or back to 1850 or wherever they wanted it to be. I mean, Congress then would have the freedom to do that, right? There would be absolutely not really a legal challenge to do that. I mean, that is, you know, we've seen the term of copyright grow and grow and grow, but it's only grown in that kind of future direction. Now this kind of seems to give it the ability to move in the past direction as well. That timeline can grow on both ends is worrying to me. Dan, is worrying to you too?
And, you know, it's like some kind of bizarre science fiction story where, you know, like the future comes to get the past. you know, I mean, it really, it's starting to read now. I mean, I feel like all these legal developments this week are out of, you know, some kind of strange Philip K. Dick novel where, you know, future cops come to get the past or, you know, take the rights of the past and exploit it in the future. And I don't know, maybe I should be wearing a foil hat right now. But, you know, I think just it's sad. I guess it's part of a larger story about the erosion of this notion of balance, which I think Breyer and Alito in their dissent made very clear that, you know, where is the incentive to create new works when you're going retrospectively like this, right? It's not, there's no incentive because it's from the past. You know, I thought they mapped out very well this notion of, you know, copyright exists to incentivize, sorry for using that word, to, you know, give incentives to creators to create works and then, you know, sell them for a limited period of time. And, you know, at some point it just gets to be absurd. The length, the breadth of this kind of copyright, you know, it only serves to enrich the creators, whereas the law, as they point out in the very first paragraph of their dissent, Breyer and Alito point to this notion of it exists to promote the useful, to promote culture, arts, ideas, these sorts of things. And that after some amount of limited amount of time, they have to go into a realm where they can be freely exchanged, and that longer tail of use is very important to the way that culture gets made and remade.
And what I found disturbing in the majority opinion was this downplaying of the incentive argument for copyright, and almost an argument that if we use copyright to make sure that Disney makes a lot of money, then we're going to get new movies and other things from Disney as a result. And so we can advance the progress of the science and the arts that way. And I think that's a very dangerous slippery slope to be on. I like the incentive argument much better.
Yeah.
If we want to see some good news, I mean, if I look for positive things in the decision, the fact that the court again emphasized the importance of fair use and that it really has to be the kind of safety valve for First Amendment concerns. It's much more than just a something to do when you can't get permission, but it's in the fabric of the discipline. And I think their support of fair use is a really positive thing. They also called for orphan works legislation in Congress, and it's really hard to think of how we can have orphan works legislation that is effective and isn't going to cost a fortune to try to implement. But it's one more incentive to push toward orphan works legislation. And the third plus with the decision is that there's no need for me to update my copyright term chart that many people consult on when things enter the public domain, because it stays the same.
Yeah, we've relied heavily on that. So,
yeah. Well, I think the thing that I'm most heartened by is the amazing fact that Justices Breyer and Alito can agree on something. I mean, in some ways that stood out to me. I couldn't believe that they shared in this dissent, those two unlikely allies against this decision. Well, anyway, moving on to something maybe a little bit lighter. We saw just to close out the podcast, we saw a story this week, or I guess last week, where the University of Nevada at Reno, their archives, had done kind of a cool little digital project, little experiment on Facebook, where they created profiles for two of their students. Now, you would think that wouldn't be that interesting to create profiles for students at a university, but these are students who had been to the university years and years ago. They created these profiles for historical students, some early students at the institution, and they maintained them, and they used archival documents to update their profile and sort of tell the story of the lives of these couple of students at the University of Nevada at Reno. Unfortunately, Facebook caught wind of this, and that it turns out that this use violates their terms of service, saying that users may not provide any false information on Facebook or create an account for anyone other than themselves without permission. And so those pages were taken down. Mills, you've done a lot of kind of student projects where you've, in fact, you're doing one this semester, using fakes in productive ways in the classroom as ways of teaching historical thinking and historical research. How do you feel about this decision by Facebook and about the efforts of the University of Nevada at Reno?
Well, first of all, you know, the way Facebook caught wind of it, I think, is that the Chronicle of Higher Education ran a story lauding the people at the University Library and Archives for this really interesting kind of teachable use of Facebook. And so that's how I'm pretty sure that's how it came to their attention in the first place, was that they got some really positive media coverage for it. So, you know, Lord knows Facebook would not want to have any sort of educational purpose in its terms of use, because that would just be crazy. One thing I would say, I mean, to me, this, like, okay, I get it. They can't have people creating fake people on Facebook. I get that. But this is not a corporation that is vigilant in that regard, and in any way, shape, or form. And I know this because I do a lot of work now in the history of human trafficking. And so sex trafficking is a big piece of that. And if you want to find an escort anywhere in the world, Facebook is your go-to source. Are you listening, Facebook? Because all you need to do is just type in escort, sexual massage, anything like that, and you get from all around the world pictures of scantily clad young men and young women and the services that they will provide you or a point to their website. Now, of course, Facebook would say, oh, well, as soon as we see that, we take those down. But there are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of such profiles of people who for sure are not the people in the photographs. And so, and I've saved, if Facebook wants to dispute me on this, I have captures of some of those, so which I use in a lecture in class about social media and sex trafficking. So it's not like Facebook is very vigilant in this regard. And so to then take down something which had a laudable educational purpose strikes me as just silly. At the same time, I understand that they really want to try to preserve the integrity of their network so that these are only real people. Well, I never saw the fake students because they were gone before I got a chance. I didn't get the story until after the story was that they'd been removed. Somehow, I bet the photographs that were used might have indicated that these people weren't really alive anymore. So it wasn't like it was a hoax or a scam. I mean, reasonable people could look at a photograph of a university student from 100 years ago and say, wow, I don't think that person still looks like that. You know, so it's too bad because I think Facebook has some real potential to be used for teaching purposes, and this just takes away the value of that. I mean, it takes away, you know, yet another opportunity for that. So it's just too bad.
Yeah, if you take a look at the pictures of the students, their pages are they've now turned those profiles into pages, which the archivists say don't really work as well because they're not they can't function as people.
They can't just be friends with people.
Right. So, but their pages are up, and if you look at their pictures on those pages, it would be pretty hard for a current student to replicate some of those hairstyles today. So they definitely are historical personages. It would be hard to miss that. Dan, any feelings on this?
No. I mean, I just think it's all part of the Nimwars and Facebook and Google just desperate to have, you know, actual people with actual names that they can actually track and give them actual ads that make them actual money.
Yeah. Well, that is I'm sure the case. I guess my only other thought on this would be that just a word of caution to people who are looking to use, and I know I've recommended people before, you know, where people are looking for a platform for the digital project and they want something quick and they want something simple, use Facebook. It's easy. It's powerful. I guess it presents a word of caution there that, you know, if you use a proprietary platform, you're, at the whims of the owners of the platform.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. I think there's a lot of educators who, you know, it's an easy default for them, easy way to make a website essentially.
And all their constituents are there. So they don't
right,
need to,
exactly.
You know, and they yep. don't need to build an authentication system, and it's all just kind of built in. And so it is easy and quick and powerful. But it is proprietary. I think we'll just end it there. Peter, thank you so much for being on with us. I think you really were able to add some expert knowledge to our normally bereft discussions of copyright and intellectual property issues. And I hope you won't mind if we ask you back to help us again.
Oh, I'd love to be back. It's been great fun. Thanks for having
me. Peter. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you to Peter. Thank you also to Mills and to Dan. And Amanda, if you're listening from the beach, be sure to wear your suntan lotion and have a margarita for us.
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself. Thank you.